Hey friends, and welcome to the Happy Hour with Jamie Ivey podcast. I'm your host, Jamie, and I'm so glad you're here. Each week on this show, I invite a friend to join me, and we chat about the big things in life, the little things in life, and everything in between. Hey friends, and welcome to another episode of the Happy Hour. Today's a guest that I'm going to be honest with you, I was a little nervous about, and I was so excited to have her on. Kay Warren joins me today, and Kay is someone who I have adored and looked up to from afar. I have met her, I have been in circles with her, all the things, and I just watch what she does and go, I want to be Kay Warren when I grow up, is what I think. And I think a lot of it is just me watching her and her husband, Rick, journey through public ministry and how they've handled it. And so I was super excited to have her on the show today. We talk a lot about how they got through ministry. I mean, literally, we're talking 42 and a half years at the same church as a pastor. There's just something to be said about that. And so she's super encouraging about their intentionality with how they made it to the end of their journey as pastors at the church with integrity, humility, and generosity. And that's going to be encouraging to you. I want to give you a little heads up that we spend the majority of our conversation today talking about mental health challenges, and even deeper than that, talking about suicide. Rick and Kay lost their son to suicide in 2013. And so we talk about mental health, the challenges within the church and without of the church, how we can be advocates for people who have these challenges. I enjoyed this conversation with Kay because it's something that she deeply understands and she deeply has a passion for helping people. One of the things that Kay has developed over the last couple of years is a ministry called Breathe. It's specifically developed to provide events and opportunities for parents of children with mental illness to talk about the reality of the struggle, to grieve together, and point each other toward hope. If this is something that you think would be beneficial to you, go check out kwarren.com and find the information about Breathe. We'll put all of that in the show notes as well. You guys, I want to be Kay Warren when I grow up. There it is. I'm so happy to bring you this conversation. What a dear, beautiful woman who loves Jesus and loves people. Here's my conversation with Kay Warren. Kay Warren, welcome to the Happy Hour.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so excited to be with you.
Well, this is super exciting for me because I have honored and loved and just really adored everything you are doing in your life from afar for a while. And so it is a joy for me to have you on the Happy Hour. And I want to start this whole conversation by saying congratulations. Service. Well done. What was it? 42 and a half years at the same church?
Yep, same church, all our entire adult lives. I don't know how to do anything else. That's all I've done our entire lives. So,
well, yeah. We're recording this on a Wednesday, and am I right that Sunday was your last Sunday?
Yeah, it was. Just, 72 hours ago, we drove away to this amazing, there was a, you know what a clap out is?
Uh-huh.
You know? So we drove out, surprise to us, this clap out of hundreds and hundreds of people yelling, screaming, telling us they loved us, weeping signs. And we just wept. We couldn't even get out the driveway. It was just the sweetest moment.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I do have a question for you because I'm married to a pastor as well. And he leaves in the morning on Sundays before I ever get up. But he always wakes me up to tell me goodbye. And so often it's just a nothing. It's like, okay, goodbye, love you. But sometimes if I know he's preaching or whatever, I know what's been going on in his world, I'll say a little something to him. What are you saying to Rick either Saturday night or Saturday morning or Sunday morning before his last day as pastor of this church?
Oh, you know, we were both kind of speechless. We just stared at each other. I posted on Instagram a picture of us as we were driving to church together that day in particular. And I just said, the last of the lasts, the first of the firsts. Because that's exactly what it was. It was the last of what we have known and done for 42 and a half years. And it's the beginning of a whole new season. And I don't know. I think we did a lot of staring into each other's eyes because the words just weren't there. They weren't adequate. They were too big.
Yeah.
It was more just something we felt.
Yeah. You know, a lot of parents, especially moms in particular, understand what I'm about to say. And I have not yet fully experienced this, but there's this feeling I've heard when the kids move out and then it's just you and your husband and you kind of go, what is this new normal? And a lot of times, unfortunately, people are like, I don't really know what to do with my life now. And I would imagine that you might be feeling a little bit like that this week. What are you feeling and what is next for you guys?
We have said, because we spent a month kind of on this goodbye tour, only it was at church. You know, yeah. We didn't go anywhere. So every service for the last month was just had some other taking people back to the 80s, into the 90s, into the 2000s, and then to, the future. And so I just kept saying, I feel big emotions. I feel big grief. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
Big grief, big relief. We did it.
Yeah.
We made it. We finished the race, this part of the race, the way that we wanted to. And big gratitude. It's like, how in the world did we get the privilege of leading this incredible congregation for 42 and a half years? How did we get to spend our entire lives doing this?
You're just like pinching yourself. Like, God, how did this happen?
Yes, the privilege of it. The we're just so grateful. So we just kind of flip between gratitude and sadness and relief that I would call it just a real deep soul satisfaction we did what we set out to do, which was to live a life of integrity, humility, and generosity. Those were the things that really mattered to us. And to be able to take a step back and say, man, we didn't do it perfectly. Mm-hmm. We didn't do it mistake-free. But there are no skeletons in the closets. There's nothing that we're just dreading that someday somebody's going to find this out. We feel like we were able to live with that kind of integrity. We began with the end in mind. That's where we wanted to be. And that's where we ended up. And so there's such a huge relief about that.
You know, it feels, I was sitting here listening to you say that, and it feels unfortunate what I'm about to say, but I'm going to say it anyways. And it feels unfortunate that as a church person, as a Christian, as a follower of Jesus, as someone in ministry, that I'm listening to you say that, I'm like, congrats on making it. I mean,
it's not easy. Wow.
Exactly. And so I meant that a little bit like unfortunately, but also is super inspiring and something that my husband and I would also yearn to finish this race well. You said you started with the end in mind. What does that look like for people who, ministry aside, just you're in your 20s, you're in your 30s, you're starting what will be, you know, quote unquote, the rest of your life. Did you guys intentionally talk about these things? This is who we want to be when we finish this part of our race.
Yes, we intentionally talked about it because both of our dads were in ministry and then we went to Bible college and then to seminary. And even by the time we finished seminary, we had already seen friends that we'd gone to college with that had already fallen by the side of the road for various reasons. And then same graduating seminary, just a short period after that, there were people that had already kind of what we call flamed out. Mm-hmm. That was an old term, but that was the term that we used. And so because of our dads being in ministry and watching people that we had known, then going to college and going to seminary, it was like, oh my gosh, this is not a walk in the park. Yeah. If we really want to get to the end of ministry, where whenever that is, with integrity, ending with that, then we're going to have to make some decisions along the road and we're going to have to start right now. And I was telling our staff wives at an event earlier this year, I said, you know, and this was before we actually knew that September 3rd and 4th, September 3rd and 4th were going to be like our last, and 11/12 was the day we're going to turn it over to the new pastor. But so back in March, I was saying, listen, you guys, you might think that day ahead of us is going to be the last day of Saddleback. But actually, we started thinking of the last day on the first day we did our Bible study, January 25th, 1980.
Wow.
Because we knew that to get to where we wanted, that end of finishing well, where we could say before God, we lived before you with honesty and integrity, in holiness and with keeping Jesus first, we're going to have to make a million decisions along the way. That means keeping the long view in every situation. And like you said, whether it's ministry or life, you want to be a certain kind of person at the end of your life. You don't get to just wake up one morning and find that you're there. You're there because you made 1,000 decisions a day that kept you centered on that goal. Mm. And you're willing to make the course corrections along the way to get you to where you want to go. It doesn't just happen. It's intentional. It's deliberate. And I really believe it's in your control. Ooh. I really believe it is in our control.
That is so good, because there are so many people here listening who know who they want to be at 80. They know who they want. I think all of us do. Like, we want to end our life well, but it is.
Nobody wants to mess up and be one of those people that you go, oh, they're a cautionary tale.
Right.
Nobody wants to do that. Nobody.
It's those small steps along the way.
It is the small decisions every single day. It's saying no to yourself over and over and over, and saying yes to God.
Wow.
And the temptation and the easy thing to do when we're tired or fatigued or really under a lot of stress, or things are just, you know, the bottom falls out. The temptation is just to say yes to yourself. Well, I need this. This is going to make me feel better. Or how come he or she gets all of that and I don't? And so I deserve this or whatever. And it's going to make me feel better right now. And whenever we do that, we just need to know that we have taken ourselves off of the path, at least temporarily,
right,
for the person we really genuinely want to be.
And I think it's good to note there's course correction. You can get back on. That is so true. It is not over. Well, Kay, you've done some phenomenal work on your own, aside from co-founding and being a part of Saddleback for all these years. You've been an advocate for people living with HIV and AIDS, vulnerable people groups. Huge advocate, and a lot of the work that you do right now is over helping families who have children who have mental health struggles and mental health challenges, I should say. I would like for you to take us back a little bit and tell me a little bit of your story as to where this became such a passion for you and for your husband, that you would spend so much of your life's work helping people with this.
Yeah. Thanks for asking that. I became an advocate for people with HIV and AIDS and for orphans and vulnerable children. That was a deliberate decision. God called me kind of out of the blue. That's a whole long story, but it was just a deliberate. There was this moment in which God said to me, this is what I'm calling you to do. Will you say yes or no? Mm. And so that was a decision that I made, to become an advocate for people with HIV and for orphans and vulnerable children. I became an advocate for people living with mental illness because I was thrust into the situation. Mm. The 10 years that I spent as a global advocate for HIV and orphans, I cried more than I'd ever cried. My heart was broken by what I saw, by the people that I encountered. But I wasn't HIV positive. None of my children were. My children were not orphans. So there was, there was a bit of distance between my caring and my compassion and my own personal experience. But when my youngest son had serious mental illness and then died by suicide on April 5th, 2013, it was not an impersonal advocacy. It was the most personal. It had landed in my home. Mm-hmm. And I knew the day that Matthew died, it's the weirdest thing. I knew, as we were waiting outside of his house for the police to confirm what we were pretty sure had happened, I had this out-of-body moment where I thought to myself, I am no longer an advocate for people with HIV and AIDS, not because I don't care, but because God has just switched my advocacy and it's going to be different from here on out. I can't walk away from this. It's too personal. It's too real. And so I have spent nearly a decade. Next April will be 10 years since Matthew went to heaven. And I've spent, you know, almost a decade from the deepest place of my heart, caring for other people living with mental health challenges, for the family members, for people living with chronic suicidal thoughts, survivors of suicide loss. It's some of the hardest work I've ever done.
I would imagine it is. And, you know, we're at the end of September, which is September is Suicide Awareness Month. And so there's been conversations and talks about it. And I know this is deeply personal for you and your husband, Rick, and it has impacted the work that you do. I want to ask you about mental health challenges and within the church. And you bring a unique viewpoint to this conversation, not only as a follower of Jesus, but as a very public church leader. And so I would imagine when you and Rick were walking through this tragedy that I hope none of us have to walk through, there was an added level of this pressure. I don't want to put words in your mouth that you might have felt. And so I'm wondering if you can talk to the stigma that so many people in the church have around mental health challenges and around people dying by suicide. Can you talk a little bit like how you've seen changes in that even?
I'll tell you the good news first. And the good
news
first is that I've seen movement and growth in the faith community to understand that mental illness, mental health challenges is not sinful. It doesn't mean that somebody is weak, that somebody doesn't have faith, that if they just memorized more verses, mm-hmm. or if they had a demon cast out of them, or, you know, we've just removed it from that purely spiritual kind of a failure on somebody's part to understanding that something can go wrong at every level in us. We're body, soul, and spirit, and things can happen in our brains. Our bodies are frail. We are jars of clay. As the church, as the faith community, begins to understand that the brain is as much a part of the body as the liver or the kidneys or the heart, then that has really helped in taking down some of the mm-hmm. stigma. That's the positive side. The other part of the reality is, though, it hasn't gone away.
Yeah.
You know, the stigma hasn't gone away. There still is, there's still some pretty deep pockets of people who still think that way. And, mm-hmm. and even if they don't think that overt stigma, I think sometimes church leaders just don't know what to do.
Yeah.
So even if their heart is turned in compassion towards somebody, they didn't get trained in seminary or yep. Bible college. They don't really know. And so they tend to think, oh, that's a person who has a mental health challenge. I need to turn them over to a professional. Mm. And there's value in that. But one of my mentors, Dr. John Swinton, is professor of disability and at University of Aberdeen in Scotland, says, what if we take that and turn that phrase? Because right now, a lot of faith leaders are saying, oh, there's a person with a mental illness. They need to see a professional.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they abdicate their responsibility for caring for a person or their family. What if we turn that around and say, oh, there's a person with a mental illness or mental health challenge, then suddenly it lands right back in our laps, because who is more equipped to deal with persons than the faith community? Mm. It's in our DNA, is to care for persons. Mental health professionals, there's a role, absolutely, but the church has a role too. And our role is to care for persons who actually may have then a mental health challenge. So I love to be able to talk to faith leaders to see where they're growing past or out of the stigma, but into that place then of helplessness. I don't know what to do, or it's not in my wheelhouse. I didn't study that. Okay, but caring for persons is in your wheelhouse.
Right.
It is actually your command by God. And so to learn and to be able to, even if the smallest thing a church does is to say in the community prayer time, communal prayer time, God, we pray for people today, men and women, boys and girls, who are living with depression, who are struggling with crippling anxiety. God, you care about your sons and daughters who are experiencing that. That right there is such a stigma buster.
Yeah, right.
And says, you are safe here. Mm. You're not put down for this. You are recognized as a person who is maybe in need of comfort or sustenance or care. And we're here to do it. Even if we don't do it perfectly, we're here to do it.
That's so good. In 2020, my husband was diagnosed with a clinical depression, and he has publicly preached from the stage about that. And there was a little maybe a little scary for him, I'm not sure. We're fine about it. But he had so many people come to him afterwards and say, I've never heard anyone talk about this from a stage, and I've been in church my whole life. Thank you for letting me feel like I'm not alone. And I think that is, even when we think about, you know, this month of September, where there might be more awareness focused on mental health challenges, even just those small moments of saying, oh, I had never heard anyone talk about this before, especially in the faith community, it can do a lot of work.
Well, it's actually life-saving. It's not just nice. Mm. It's not just, oh, that's a kind thing to do, or it actually saves lives. Mm. When people feel that they are accepted and cared for, and that they are not other, but that they are very much, you know, when Aaron, I've not met Aaron, but I know his name. So when Aaron, I'm imagining, said that and got that kind of response from the congregation, he normalized mm-hmm. what a mental health challenge looked like, because people could say, oh, I know Pastor Aaron. He's been preaching here all these years. He teaches the Bible. If he has depression, then it must be okay for me. Yeah. I'm not weird or strange or a bad Christian. Mm. And so to give mental health challenges a face like that was powerful. Yeah. That was powerful work, powerful ministry that he has done by saying that.
Well, I will tell him what you said, and he will be appreciated. But I think about that even with my podcast here at the Happy Hour. We've tried to have people to come on to normalize conversations around this. Right. And I'm telling you, even by hosting this show, I have learned so much that I wouldn't have known, because it didn't personally affect me. I remember when Kayla Stockline came on, and I learned in that conversation about the phrase death by suicide versus committed suicide. And I was telling my family last night at dinner that I was going to be talking to you, and I was telling them what we're going to talk about, and I was telling them how I had learned that. And it was just those small things to help go, oh, we can have these conversations and we don't have to be afraid of them. I think that is what can be so encouraging to the church, to be able to have these conversations.
Well, and I think, you know, I talked a few minutes ago about how I was an advocate for people with HIV for a decade. And you talk about stigma. Again, there's stigma, still in the faith community. But as I was a global advocate and I would travel around to other places, I got used to men and women coming up and whispering in my ear, I'm HIV positive or I have AIDS. And the reason they whispered in my ear was because the stigma, even, you know, 15 years ago, was enormous, particularly in some other parts of the world where maybe there wasn't even as much an understanding about how HIV is transmitted. And so people would say, I lost my friends. Mm. I couldn't sit next to people in church anymore. People stopped sitting next to me. Well, who wants that? They wouldn't let other people play with other kids, play with my kids. So they would whisper to me because of the stigma. What I wasn't expecting was, still to this day, when I talk to people in faith communities and I travel, I will have people come up to me and whisper in my ear, I just got a diagnosis of depression. Mm. My dad died by suicide, and I've never really talked about it. Or I have borderline personality disorder. They will come and they will whisper either their diagnosis or their life circumstance, because the stigma is still present. Mm. And what I've come to believe is that nobody should have to whisper anything about their lives in church.
The church needs to
be the safest place on earth, where you don't have to whisper about anything. You can bring it into the place where God has intended for you to find life and love and relationship and acceptance and comfort and strength. So Aaron, I'm serious. What he did is he made it so that people don't have to whisper in your church, and that's good for him.
We should have a sign at our church that says there's no whispering allowed. No whispering here, guys. You know, there's a flip side of this that you and your husband have endured as well, is that's parenting. And you have started an organization that really seeks to help families who are walking beside and along children and loved ones who are experiencing mental health challenges. And you guys have been very open about your son Matthew's journey with mental health, and that it was from a young age he struggled with depression and anxiety. A lot of times parents feel very much alone in this journey, feel very much, what did I do wrong? What do I do? What is the hope for parents as they're journeying alongside either their 7-year-old or their 25-year-old or their 42-year-old? What is the hope, and how are some things that you can say to encourage them in that journey if they're listening to us?
Yeah, well, yeah, I need about 3 hours to talk about that.
That's going
to
be a 6-week series that we're going to bring you guys.
Yes, I'll be back next week at the same time. Yes. I have. I started an organization called Breathe, and it's not an acronym. It just is. Parenting a child with serious mental illness is it's a long journey. And when I was growing up and we would go see family, we lived in California. When we go see family back in Texas, we didn't have the money to stay in motels or anything. So we counted on these rest stops all the way along between California and West Texas, where you could stop and you could go to the bathroom and you could get, you know, something to drink and you could just refresh yourself and keep going. And so mental illness can be a long journey. And to have these rest spots along the way where parents can kind of stop and just breathe and get refreshed and kind of get them back on the road is really important to me. I didn't have that when Matthew was really ill. I was fortunate. I was in a church where we talked about mental health challenges. Although as he got older, I didn't talk as much because it was his story.
It's his story, yeah.
He needed some privacy. Mm-hmm. But so even though we were surrounded by people who loved us and cared for us, our friends knew, there was still that, as you said, just this sense of loneliness and aloneness. And I'm telling you, it's hard to sit in a Bible study group and have everybody else, you know, doing the catch up at the beginning of the week. And, you know, people are saying, oh, yeah, listen, my son just got this scholarship to Yale. And somebody else says, oh, you know what? My daughter just got selected for the dance team at whatever. And you're sitting there just going, you know what? My kid just punched a hole in the wall and talked about wanting to die. Mm. And I just remember there were times I would get up from the table during that sharing time and go to the bathroom and hope that when I came back that everybody kind of moved on, ready to start the lesson of the day. Because if you don't have other people who are normalizing your own life, you can feel very much an outsider, even with people that you know love you and care for you. Mm. So I wanted to make sure that other parents have some things that we didn't have. Resources. We didn't know where really to look. We didn't know where to get information. You can go to the internet, but then it's a bottomless pit. And once you get started on it, you can't ever find the end of it. And so how do you know what information to trust? And so my website is developed particularly so that people either living with mental illness or family members can go and just like really quickly access information, not all of it that I've developed, but I've curated.
Yeah.
I found from trusted resources, and I've, you know, it's free things that are there on the website. So I want to make sure that they've got resources. I want to make sure that there are support groups. We have some support groups that we really love here at Saddleback. I have these respite retreats for mothers of kids with serious mental illness. And then we do some Zoom calls with really trusted mental health experts for parents. So it's moms and dads. Mm-hmm. I just don't want any of those other parents to feel the hopelessness and the despair and the isolation and that there's something wrong with them. There isn't. We all have things that we carry in our lives that are very difficult. And to find somebody else who's carrying that same burden, and it just makes life, it makes it bearable.
It totally does. And totally different way of struggle that I might have walked through with my kids and parenting. It is very comforting when you can be in a room with someone who you don't have to explain everything and they just get it.
Yes.
And I felt so deeply what you said about having friends in my own life personally that love me deeply, like would step in front of a train for me, and yet don't understand the unique dynamics of some of the things in my family that have been difficult. And so finding those people is just gold. Your retreats that you do for moms, is this the one where Dr. Bruce Perry is coming?
Well, he's going to be doing a Zoom call. Okay. He's actually doing one of our calls in October. I'm taping with him in a few weeks. And he is just the bomb. He is amazing.
Well, I only know his work from his most recent book with Oprah, and yeah. I listened to it, and I have literally brought it up like 5 times this week with people, because I think it's such a help. How you mentioned to me that just even learning about neuroscience, and it's so funny. My son, who's he's a freshman in college, he was telling me last night about something in his psychology class, and he's like, "Oh, this is a bunch of brain stuff." I'm like, "Do you like it? Because if so, I have a lot of books I can give you, because I too, like you, have enjoyed this whole new understanding of how our brain affects everything about us." So tell me what it's been like for you in the last couple of years of getting to know his work and other people's work.
Yeah, well, the book that you're referring to is called What Happened to You. And the premise of that book is that often with kids or with children or just difficult people in our lives, our response to their being difficult or their being hard to manage, or whatever, is what comes out of our mouths is what's wrong with you, mm-hmm. and he reframes it as what happened to you, and talks so much about trauma and particularly childhood trauma. And I mean, I'm a survivor of childhood sexual abuse, had that trauma in my life, and worked and still working through a lot of that myself, so I could identify with that. But I'm not a science person. And I think that's what I love about them. I was a home ec major, for Pete's sake.
Look at you.
I mean, it's even a non-existent major. Right. People don't even know what it is. Yeah. Home.
Yep.
So not a science person at all. But he makes it accessible.
Yeah.
And for me to understand, this is during COVID is when I really kind of latched onto that. He was putting out all these little 20-minute videos that explained why, well, obviously there was the reasons why we were struggling during COVID, but what was happening to our brains mm-hmm. Under the kind of stress that none of us were used to living under. And as he was explaining what happens and how we get triggered and then what that does to our brain and how then it can lead to conflict or we're overreacting over something and we don't even know why, but he would just kind of draw these pictures. And I just went, where were you
right.
when I got married 47 years ago?
Yeah.
And well, some of the conflict Rick and I have had, some of the ways that I responded to my kids, mm-hmm. even just normal things, for let sure. alone mental health challenges, and explained to myself, oh my goodness, when this and this happens to me, this is what I do. No wonder.
Yeah.
I didn't feel even a mystery to myself. Mm. I was like, I could see, oh, my brain isn't online right now. My brain has gone offline. Yep. Because when you said that, it landed here at the, you know, at the base of my brain rather than up here where I make logical decisions. Yep. And it had to go all the journey up all those different parts of the brain to get to the logical part. And by the time it got to the logical part, I was offline completely. It just has been revolutionary to me. And it's made me, I told him one time when we were talking, I said, your work makes me want to go back and redo every relationship in my life.
Yeah,
I want to redo my parenting. I want to redo my marriage. I want to redo my time with my son with his mental illness, because there was just stuff I didn't get.
Yep.
And I didn't understand how it was affecting the way that I was interacting.
Yeah.
So for me, it has just been like, you know, mind blowing.
I listened to that book. I believe it was earlier this year. It's been within the past 12 to 18 months. And for those of you that are listening to this podcast, you'll appreciate this, is when I was listening to it, him and Oprah Winfrey read it together, and it felt so much like a conversation. And so for me, I felt like I was listening to a podcast, but I was actually listening to a book. And yeah. Oprah talks about past guests, and Dr. Perry brings his knowledge in. They're reading the book, obviously, but it was so good. And I, like you, Kay, totally found myself going, oh, this was what the reaction from myself was, or this is where the reaction from one of my kids comes from, or my husband. And it just changes everything. I think it's a must read for everybody. Everybody should read this book.
It's on my list of must reads for everybody.
Yeah. It's life changing for sure. You also said you've loved the Enneagram so far as well. You're an Enneagram 1. Is that what you said?
Yes. I'm just laughing because it's just one of those things that was scared to death of, you know, when I first heard of it, I don't know, 15 years ago, however long ago. First of all, I didn't like the diagram. It looked too much like a pentagram. And so therefore it was like, I'm not getting anywhere near that stuff, whatever that is. That is not for me.
Right.
But again, I probably during COVID, when I had some extra time on my hands, I was not traveling speaking places, and I was just doing a lot of learning and really became just started reading and learning. And again, I had an epiphany about myself that changed me. That probably a year and a half later, we have a time at Christmas where we go birthday party for Jesus, old family tradition. And part of what we do is we go around and we say, you know, what are you grateful for this year? And what are you going to give Jesus next year? And my two oldest kids said to me at the birthday party for Jesus, what they were most grateful for that year was that I had discovered the Enneagram.
I love that.
I'm like, I can't decide if I'm offended or by that. But they just said it changed the way that I related to them. Mm-hmm. And that as a one, as a reformer, fixer, perfecter, whatever term you want to use, if I'm not careful, I can be very judgmental, highly critical, and always looking for perfection. Well, that carried over into my relationships, and my kids were seeing the growth in me of where I could step back and look at myself, see that about myself, own it, and say, that's not the way I want to be. That's not the way I want to make you feel. I don't want to make you feel like you're having to meet. That's not how I want to relate to you.
Yeah.
And so, but what it was what I saw about myself that allowed me to start working on some really rough edges. Mm-hmm. And it has this sentence, it's the simplest sentence of all, but it goes over in my head all the time. It's changed my marriage as well, which is, oh, you're different from me. Mm. Now, that just seems like the most no-brainer sentence ever. But I can honestly tell you, I never operated out of that before. Now, sometimes, particularly with Rick, and he and I are polar opposites, always have been polar opposites. And places where I would used to get into an argument with him, I step back now and just say, oh, I'm seeing this situation like this. Is that the way you're seeing it? And he'll go, no, not at all. I was saying, I see it like this. And then I find myself just going, oh, okay, then, well, never mind. Because there's nothing to argue about anymore.
Yeah.
Because we are approaching it so differently that what I was taking offense at or what I was getting judgmental about was not even necessary.
I'm such a fan of the Enneagram as well. It has been a helpful tool in my marriage as well. And it is just a tool. And I love it so much because it's this tool. Just like all the things that even Dr. Perry is teaching or anyone is teaching, Dr. Thompson, they give us these tools and they say, hey, here's some more tools. Put them in your tool belt and then let the Holy Spirit do his work. And so I love hearing that. Kay, I want to ask you a question that I didn't plan on asking. And I just feel it in here. Before we go, we've talked about mental health and we've talked about the church and the stigmas and stuff. I just want to ask you if you can tell us just a little bit about Matthew and tell us what you loved about him and a little bit of what you remember and how you really cherish him for the 27 years that he was here.
Thanks. Makes me cry, but it's okay. Because there's nothing sweeter to a mother's ear than to talk about her child, particularly a child who's died. Because people are often afraid to bring up your child as though it's going to upset you and make you cry. But it's like, but that's, how would I not want to talk about? I love him. Of course I want to talk about him. So thank you. Thanks for asking, Jamie. Matthew, we knew really from very soon. I had a really difficult pregnancy. And even looking back, don't know if, you know, what happened in utero was, you know, rearranged his brain. I don't know. But regardless, from very early, he was different than my other two. So there was always stuff to think about with him that I hadn't had to think about with the other two. But he grew into the most creative, kind, very much the underdog. The world lost, really, an advocate for vulnerable people when Matthew died. I took him on some of the trips that I did during the years that I was a global HIV advocate, because I thought if he saw people who were, quote, worse off than he was, that would snap him out of some of his depression. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things sometimes I think that comes with suicide. You can feel a lot of regret that you didn't understand necessarily how hard things were for somebody. And I definitely didn't understand that when he was a teenager. I kept thinking that I could either talk him out of it, or I could expose him to some other experience and that would snap him out of it, instead of understanding his own pain and struggle. But what it did for Matthew is it actually made it harder for him, because he was already very tender-hearted, very caring. And as he saw the suffering of other people, it just broke his heart even. And he didn't have the capacity to carry that much of a heartbreak. And I heard from people, I still hear from people almost 10 years later, who will tell me some incident, some encounter they had with Matthew where he was looking out for them, or he was looking out for their kid. He was watching for the underdog. He was doing what he could to care for them. And I loved that about him. He had a ridiculous sense of humor, totally inappropriate, where I was always going, Matthew, stop that, or whatever. And nothing made him happier than to get that response.
Yeah, I'm sure.
He was funny and creative and kind, and this healthy Matthew was creative and kind and loving and cared for other people. As the illness took over, a lot of that became submerged under the layers of illness. And, but every once in a while that would still be who popped up, and I knew who he was in his real self. I knew who he was in his real self, even as his self that was very ill became frightening and, extremely unstable and just, scary in some ways he was, but who he was, the essence of him, was precious and beautiful and kind. And he loved his mama.
Oh, thank you for sharing him with us. And to not sound, churchy or cliche, it is a beautiful thing to know and believe that he has no more illness.
Yes.
It is beautiful. And Kay, what a joy to chat with you today. And I know that there are a lot of people who, even just listening to our conversation, who feel immensely seen in this conversation. Because the older I get, I just don't find a lot of people whose lives are not affected by mental health in some way or another. And I'm grateful for the research. I'm grateful for the conversations. I'm grateful for more awareness. And I know that you've had a huge role in that, even though at the beginning, like you said, you were kind of thrust into this advocacy and would have rather done something else, I'm sure. But we're grateful for your voice. I would love to hear from you now in all your free time. I don't even know what you're going to do with your life anymore. What are you reading these days?
Jamie wants to know. We
want to
know what you're reading.
Well, I just finished Celebrities for Jesus by, I always say her name wrong, Caitlin Beattie. And if I say her name wrong, I'm sorry. I always read it in print, but don't hear it pronounced. Just finished that. I love Henry Nouwen. I'm reading his book Prayer, taking it kind of a little chunk at a time. It's been exactly what I needed this year. Rereading Larry Crabb's 30-year-old book, Inside Out. It changed my life when I first read it.
Wow, I'm going to note that.
I'm telling you, it is a powerful book. It will rock your socks. Okay. It will knock your socks off. It's a fabulous book. When I first read it, I remember I was 37 and I came to Rick and I said, I just realized that I have some issues with control. And he said, you think? I've only been trying to tell you that for the 15 years that we've been married. And I'm like, yeah, but I knew I always had control, but I didn't know it was a thing.
Right.
I will never forget. It was the first time in my life I understood I have control issues and it's something that needs to be worked on. So,
well, maybe I don't want to read it then, Kay. Maybe it's going to step all over my toes.
yeah, it's so good. Inside Out, prayer, reading this book that is, I can only read a section at a time because it's so intellectual. It's way over my head, but it's called the sound of Life's Unspeakable Beauty.
Okay.
Translated from the German by Martin Shelsky. And he's a luthier, I guess. He makes violins.
Oh, okay.
And he compares all of life to the making of a violin.
Wow.
And it is beautiful the way that he puts phrases and words together. I was reading it again this morning and I could only read a paragraph because I had to stop to absorb. Not in that kind of heady way that like somebody's trying to impress you with their words. It's just, he has a way that I have to think about. Anyway, those are things I'm reading right now.
Sounds beautiful. Well, Kay, congratulations on the service at Saddleback for 42 and a half years. And I can't wait to see the next half of your life and where God takes you and Rick and the work that you're doing. So thanks for coming on the Happy Hour today.
I love talking to you. Thank you so much, Jamie.
Thank you so much for listening to the Happy Hour with Jamie Ivey podcast. We are truly grateful for every single story that we get to share with you, every encouragement we get to give you, and every opportunity we get to point all of us to Jesus. If you're loving this show, we would really appreciate it if you would leave us a rating and or a review wherever you listen to podcasts. Also, tell your friends. That is the number one way that people find out about our show. It's because you tell them. Join us right here every Wednesday and Friday for meaningful conversations that will make us think, they'll make us laugh, and they'll always point us back to Jesus. And come find me other places on the internet as well. I love Instagram. I'm over there at Jamie Ivey. And if you've never visited my YouTube page, you're going to want to go there. Have you ever listened to a show and wondered, I wonder what they look like? Well, go find us over there. It's jamieivey.com/YouTube.
The Happy Hour with Jamie Ivey is a production of Ivey Media Podcasts. Executive produced by Jamie Ivey. Produced by Lindsay Sweeney. Edited by Angie Elkins. Show notes by Ashley Miner. Art by Jen Jett Barrett. Original music by Matt Graham. And I'm your host, Jamie. Have a happy hour with a friend.